tripped in towards Lewandowski!
Magnificent from Cristiano Ronaldo!
Harry Kane, 1-0 England!
Ibrahimovic! Oh, he certainly made the most of that!
You're listening to the official UEFA Euro 2016 podcast.
Hello and welcome to our third show from Paris. I'm Rob Daly. As always, we have interviews with the biggest names, including Gareth Bale, Cristiano Ronaldo and Daniel Sturridge.
We're not through yet, so we're not getting too excited about it. We've got another game to go. We have to focus.
The second round of group games threw up some magic moments.
It's Rabbit's cross, Griezmann! They found the way at last!
Ali, Sturridge, Sturridge!
Good run from Eddie.
Can he go all the way here? Oh, you bet he can!
We'll speak to our team of journalists across France, based with national teams, on the UEFA Euro 2016 podcast. Joining us as always for the third edition of the show, UEFA.com journalist Tom Kell.
Thanks, Rob.
Also alongside me is Chris Parrott. Chris, hello.
Hello, Rob.
Tom, I know you weren't too happy with our makeshift studio before. I've got you a big window here with a sort of view of the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, there is, very much is a view. It's a bit cloudy today, but it's nice that it's not raining. And it's nice to be away from the broadcast centre where I don't have to wear my uniform. Chris seems to have kept his uniform on for the occasion.
I didn't get that part of the memo.
Well, don't worry about it, Chris. You look very smart indeed, so don't worry at all. Chris, some teams have already qualified now for the round of 16. Can you just clarify who's already through before their final group game?
Only three teams, which means there's so much at stake on match day three, Rob. Italy, 2012 finalists, are the only team who have won their group. They're through. Spain are also through, haven't yet won their group. And France are the third team, definitely in the last 16. They need to avoid defeat against Switzerland, though, to win their section. And only one of the 24 teams can't make it through, which is Ukraine, because as well as the group winners and the group runners-up, the four best third-place sides go through. So there is basically everybody has something to play for going into their last match.
Portugal take on Hungary, Tom, after a frustrating night for Cristiano Ronaldo. The Parc des Princes, that 0-0 draw with Austria. Just didn't happen for him.
No, it was one of those nights, wasn't it? I mean, you know, he obviously had some good opportunities. You know, at the same time, he was their biggest threat and their main threat. I've read that Portugal have had 50 shots in their first two games.
And well, that's a lot.
Yeah, and only scored once. But Ronaldo is, I think you've said it before, he's relentless. He's going to keep coming. Be absolutely positive that he's going to score on match day three.
Were you surprised that he missed that penalty? Hit the post later.
Yeah,
it
was
the kind of moment made for him to win the game.
Yeah, it was one of those occasions we were all in the broadcast centre and I think there was more noise after that miss than there has been for any moment so far.
Well, I was in with the Austrian fans and the game at the Parc des Princes and they were treating it almost like a win. And I suppose what's interesting has been the use of Ronaldo as more of a centre forward with the Portuguese team. Do you think that's the right call, Tom? Would you like to see him playing wide as he usually does?
I guess at a major tournament, you get your best player in the position where he's going to cause most damage. You know, he might not have scored yet, but he's had plenty of chances. He had 10 shots in the first game. Not sure how many he had in the second. Something similar, I'm sure. I think it's been a problem for Portugal for a while. They don't tend to produce absolute top draw, out-and-out strikers. Someone from the Portuguese office was actually saying that it's a cultural problem almost in Portugal. Kids don't grow up wanting to be a striker. They grow up wanting to be a winger, you know, a Figo. They've had quite a good history of wingers and they don't have number nines in the Alan Shearer mould.
So
you'd
stick with it effectively?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we could easily be sitting here discussing a Ronaldo hat-trick at the Parc des Princes. It was sometimes these things happen that the Austria goalkeeper had a fantastic game. I do wonder if there's maybe more of a decision to make on set pieces. I saw a stat, 36 tournament free kicks now. For Portugal and he hasn't scored. You know, most teams, one guy gets one or two. If they don't go according to plan, someone else steps up and you never know. We saw with Eric Dier, that was a shot for England against Russia and then he pinged it in the top corner. So I just wonder whether the likes of Moutinho or Guerrero might get a look in. I don't know. Echoing what Tom said, Ronaldo may well bang one in on match day three anyway.
All three,
and everyone will be eating their words.
Just talking while we're on Eric Dier, I saw a great tweet from the official Spurs account of a picture of him next to David Beckham with some the caption along the lines of two great free kick takers of our time.
I think Eric Dier's got a way to go before that. On that game, in that game against Austria, Cristiano Ronaldo actually broke Luis Figo's appearance record for the national team. Let's hear what Ronaldo had to say to Euro2016.com afterwards.
Obviously, yes, it's a reason to be proud, reaching 128 international matches and beating the legendary Figo. I know deep down he's also proud of that. Obviously, it was a goal of mine to be the most capped international player and also to be the national team's top scorer. But obviously, I'm a bit sad because this wasn't the way I wanted to break this record. The most beautiful way would have been, well, we wanted to win, and we couldn't. We drew, so it wasn't how I envisaged it.
Cristiano Ronaldo speaking there. Austria fans absolutely delighted with their points, which keeps them in the hunt to qualify for the next match day. Chris, Iceland play Austria, Portugal, Hungary in the next set of games, and Iceland and Hungary played out that 1-1 draw.
I think both camps had admitted before the tournament this was the one they were targeting, but Group F is really topsy-turvy. You have Hungary top with 4 points, Iceland second with 2, Portugal third, Austria fourth. I could easily have made a case before the tournament that it would have been totally roles reversed, and that point for Hungary, the own goal in the last minute after Gylfi Sigurdsson had given Iceland the lead from the penalty spot, really shifted the group massively into Hungary's favour. I think there's been a massive amount of goodwill towards Iceland, and rightly so. They're this tiny nation, first ever major championship, and that would have been their first ever win. But from Hungary's point of view, first major tournament for 30 years. I think any other Euro, any other group, we'd be talking about the fact they're on the cusp of a place in the last.
They'd be the plucky underdogs.
They would, yeah. And it was a great atmosphere in Marseille, and as he said, Hungary with that late point puts them in a really fantastic position.
Okay, let's quickly, before we talk about Italy's qualification, we'll talk about Belgium against the Republic of Ireland, Tom, a 3-0 win.
Yeah, they were good, weren't they? I thought, good to see Lukaku among the goals. They had a very good season for Everton, very good striker. And I think the key, though, I mean, even though he got the goals, is that they got the most out of the midfielders behind him. They've got some, you know, an absolute array of attacking talent. And it seems, even in the last World Cup and in the first game, that they just didn't know how to use it. But they were creating chances, and Ireland really didn't really have much of a sniff, to be honest. And they're going to really struggle. They're going to have to bounce back quickly if they're going to have a chance of getting through.
OK, let's get some reaction from the Ireland camp next. Here are the thoughts of defender Seamus Coleman.
We knew Belgium were a good team and they would have a lot of the ball. And we came in at 0-0 and we're quite solid, and came out for the second half, and They got a goal from what would have been our free kick, which was disappointing. They broke on us, and I suppose when you go 1-0 down, you're trying to get a goal back, and you're starting to leave gaps at the back. And with the quality they had today on show, they punished us, and it's disappointing.
Is it a case now of forgetting this one as quickly as possible and moving on to Italy?
Yeah, we have to. Yeah, I'm sure. The manager might look at a couple of things that went wrong today and address it and tell us what he thinks. But we just got to look forward now and got a big game against Italy.
Is it hard to lift yourselves as a team when you suffer a defeat like that?
When you suffer a defeat at any time, it's disappointing, and there's always that period where you're disappointed. But when we wake up tomorrow morning, there's no point feeling sorry for ourselves. We have to get ready to go again.
Seamus Coleman there, already looking ahead to the Italy game. And for many Belgian fans, they've tweeted into the podcast to say that Lukaku's goals have been the highlight of the tournament for them. We've had loads of people get in touch, actually, on Twitter, telling us about their favourite moments of the competition so far. Magdalena says, Jerome Boateng preventing that goal at Germany's first match against Ukraine, that wonderful goal line clearance. Ray Tax on Twitter says, Modric's goal against Turkey, that long-range volley. Gedin says displays of Iniesta in the two games so far, especially against the Czechs. And Burak Sezgin says the Turkish fans who stayed behind for 20 minutes after the final whistle against Spain to sing. There has been great support throughout the tournament so far. Chris, back to Belgium against Ireland briefly. Why were the Belgians so different this time around compared to the 2-0 defeat to Italy?
I thought Mark Wilmot's made crucial changes to his team selection. We spoke about in the last podcast about maybe not needing Nainggolan, Witsel and Fellaini. In the end, two of them dropped out, but he played two holding midfielders and then three natural attackers behind Lukaku. And it meant that De Bruyne was central, picking up the ball. Yannick Carrasco, who was so good in the UEFA Champions League final, came into the team, and they just looked more balanced. They played more as a team, maybe, than a collection of individuals, and all of a sudden you thought, this is why they're ranked second in the world.
So Belgium are very much in the hunt now for a place in the round of 16. Italy have already qualified. They take on the Republic of Ireland next. Let's speak to our correspondent based with the Azzurri.
To keep up to date with the latest from UEFA Euro 2016, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or follow us on SoundCloud.
Joining us now to talk about the Italian team's qualification for the round of 16 is our correspondent based with the team, Paolo Menicucci. Paolo, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure.
Paolo, how satisfying was it, do you think, for Azzurri fans to see their team qualify with a game to spare?
It's very satisfying, I think, because expectations were not really high for Italy this year. Usually you give for granted that Italy qualify from a group stage, but this year not many believe that three games could be over the tournament for Italy, because the expectations were really low. Don't really understand why, because they qualified without losing a single game, but there was not much faith in this team in Italy, I have to say.
I suppose before the tournament, Paolo, there was a sense that maybe Italy didn't have the strength up front that they had in previous years. But how impressed have you been with the partnership of Edda and Pella up front?
If you compare with the past, obviously there is less talent in this group of forwards. You cannot deny that. But I think Conte selected the players that really are adapted to play this kind of football. Everyone is ready to play for the team. No one is selfish. They run a lot. They are the first to defend, to help the team defending. And maybe they're not stars that known everywhere, but they are really efficient for this kind of team and the way Conte want Italy to play.
Obviously, that back line for Juve has been pivotal with the three Juve defenders and goalkeeper as well. How impressed have you been with Italy's defending, Paolo?
They have been amazing, but this is not a surprise. Like Juventus in Serie A this season beat the record for not conceding for over 900 minutes, and they've been playing together for many years now. And even before the tournament, Conte said that this was the main strength of the national team. And they just confirmed it. Like not only didn't concede any goals in two games, but the opponents were limited to two shots on target in two games. Belgium had two shots on target, Sweden had none. So, I mean, they've been amazing. They face difficult opponents as well, because, I mean, Belgium has players like Hazard, De Bruyne, Lukaku, Zlatan Ibrahimovic yesterday, and two shots on target in two games is nothing.
I know you caught up with the match winner from the Sweden game, Edder, after the game. What did he have to say?
Edder was you can understand the spirit of this team when you talk to all of these guys. They don't want to speak about what they did, even if Edder scored a brilliant goal. He's always the first to talk about the players who came from the bench to help the team, or maybe even just the players that are not playing that come into the pitch to celebrate their goals. The team spirit is the main strength of this team, and they want to stress every time they're talking with us.
Well, now they've qualified as well, Paolo. Antonio Conte has hinted at making changes. Is there anyone especially that you think will come in?
He said from even before the first game that everyone in the squad that would have played. And I think this is the perfect chance to give everyone some minutes. And because if Ireland is not winning, Italy are first, or whatever the results in the last game. And I expect many changes, especially because there are a few players that are one yellow card away from being suspended. So I guess they will not play against Ireland. And I'm talking about two important pieces of the defense, like Bonucci and Chiellini especially. So I think Ogbonna will have a chance. I think the Shio could play on the right. I think El Shaarawy could play on the left. And the attacking couple could be different with Zaza and Immobile probably starting.
And after two wins, Paolo, do you get the sense that expectation has changed in Italy? That perhaps expectation has increased of how well Italy can do at this tournament?
A bit, yes, because everyone start to most appreciate the spirit of this team. Like this, they are really working together well. Maybe they're not the star of the past, but the spirit of the team is good, and the people start to like it. Obviously, like you had to with the knockout stage. Probably, if you win a couple of games there, then the excitement will grow. But at the moment, you still people that say, okay, but they will go out in the first game of the knockout stage. And this yesterday, they were not as good as they were against Belgium. And they still have to win the fate of the fans, I think. But they have a chance to do it.
From the way you're talking about the players, it seems like there's a very good mood in that team camp in Montpellier at the moment. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. It's like you can see from every training too. Like I was talking to other journalists today, and we've never seen something like that in other tournaments. Like this team is really a group of friends. Like they are, you see them joking all the time, and then when the training starts, like you don't see one joke. Like everyone doing what Conte is asking is exactly what the atmosphere is brilliant so far in the group.
Paolo, I know it's tough. It's really been a team effort from Italy so far. But if you had to pick out one player who's stood out so far, who would it be?
Bonucci has been outstanding so far. Like especially the first game, he was like everywhere in defense, and he had a great pass for Giaccherini's opening goal. I think Bonucci is the player that's grown the most, because when he first came to Juventus, he was a good defender, but making a few mistakes here and then. And now he's playing with such confidence. Like you can see, even trying dangerous, difficult things during the game. But he has such confidence that he's doing everything right at the moment.
Paolo, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We'll catch up with you later in the tournament.
It was a pleasure.
Follow UEFA Euro 2016 on the go.
Not convincingly cleared, and there's Müller. Wouldn't you just know it?
It is Bale. It's the second for Wales.
Download the official app now.
Okay, let's switch our attention to Group D next, because Spain take on Croatia in their final group game. Spain have already qualified for the next round, while Turkey take on the Czech Republic. Chris and Tom still with me. Chris, Czech Republic battling back to a 2-2 draw against Croatia in their last game. Effectively keeps them in the hunt. But there's a bad bit of team news, really, from that one.
Yeah, I mean, it was a massive point for them. But Tomas Rosicki out injured for the rest of the tournament with a thigh problem, which is a big blow for the Czech Republic and for him personally. I think more than 100 caps for his country. He's 35 now. You wonder whether this might have been his last major tournament. And if it is, it's a very disappointing way to have gone out, given he made his debut 16 years ago.
Yeah, extraordinary. And he even said after the game that Croatia was superior in that 2-2 draw. Let's hear from the Czech Republic goalkeeper, Petr Cech.
When you are 2-0 down, when you're such a great team, then you know your chances are getting slimmer every minute. But we managed to dig deep and get back in the game. And 2-2 is a great result at the end. We have a point and we have everything in our hands for the last game.
So both Turkey and the Czech Republic still in the hunt for a round of 16 spots. Spain already there, Tom. And I suppose ahead of facing Croatia, that 3-0 win against Turkey. I mean, they just looked so convincing in that performance.
They're really starting to gather momentum now, aren't they? Del Bosque was asked after the game to compare this team to the one of 2008 and 2012, and he was reticent to do so. But they're really starting to show, I think, that they're the real deal. A few players retired, some real key players departed since those tournament wins, but they're going to be maybe not the team to beat, but maybe one of two or three, I think, certainly.
There was some magic from Iniesta. Once again, he won the Man of the Match award. He was wonderful in midfield. But it looks like that front line might be coming together because, I mean, you mentioned the 2008 and 2012 team. Morata and Nolito were part of neither.
Yeah, and there was the goal, the Morata header. I think that was sort of a different type of goal than we're used to seeing from Spain, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
A bit more direct, a plan B, possibly. You know, the style that won them all those tournaments. Maybe 2 years ago at the World Cup, there was a sign that they'd sort of been, not found out, but teams had worked out a way to stay compact, stop them passing through. And they still do that. You know, the third goal, I think it was a ridiculous number of passes.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Yeah.
There was only one player that didn't touch the ball in that move. So,
is that true? That's amazing.
So they've still got it. They can still, but they need a plan B. They've got more options than possibly ever. Yeah, if anyone can beat them, then they're going to go a long way.
I also wonder, and we talked on one of the earlier podcasts about them not having a Torres or a Villa, but they've scored as many goals as anybody. Them and France are the top scorers, and they haven't conceded. And if you look at that back five of De Gea, Juanfran, Jordi Alba, Piqué and Ramos, with the protection they get from their midfield.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
And they haven't lost since 2004 in this tournament. I think 12 years to the day on the 20th of June was the last time they lost.
They haven't lost in this tournament since 2004?
Yeah, I was like, I was about five back then. I can't even remember that.
You weren't five. You're definitely lying there. Okay, elsewhere in the tournament, England against Wales was one of the big matches of match day two. All three of us were at the game in Lens. Here's a reminder of how the drama unfolded.
Bale it is. Oh, thunderous! He's done it again! Gareth Bale, Wales hero! He's come out for Sturridge. And someone can tuck it in. Jamie Vardy for England. 1-1. Vardy, Ali, Sturridge. Sturridge! That's the goal England have been crying out for.
Well, he was the match winner off the bench. Roy Hodgson made his changes and they paid off. Here's England striker and Liverpool striker Daniel Sturridge.
It was a pass from, I think, Rose. He played it to me. I flicked the ball inside to Vardy, and Vardy played it to Dele Alli, and Dele did a great turn in the box. I thought it should have been a penalty, but I just carried on playing, to be fair, and managed to poke it in the back of the net. Of course it does, but we're not through yet, so we're not getting too excited about it. We've got another game to go. We have to focus in, you know, in the coming days, recover well, and look forward to the next match.
So Sturridge with that winner, 2 minutes into added time. Jamie Vardy off the bench to score as well. 4 goals in his last five. Tom, you're in the press area for the game. I suppose now Roy Hodgson has even bigger team selection headaches as a result of how well the subs did.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sturridge, I think, was probably, he was maybe fourth or fifth among the strikers going before the squad was chosen.
Absolutely,
yeah. He was struggling to make the cut more than anyone. Personally, anyway, I see it that he's now the one that's fought his way into the starting 11. Vardy was good when he came on, but Sturridge, it was just, he showed a degree of arrogance, I think. He showed more dare than any other England player had in that first 45 minutes. I think within 2 or 3 minutes after coming on, picked the ball up, ran at them, tried to take on 2 or 3 players. And that's the great thing about this England team up front. The options, they're all so different. They've got all these strikers and every single one of them offers something totally different. And no one else has got that. There's been a few reports about the lack of real top draw strikers at the tournament.
Yeah, we haven't seen many goals from them so far, yeah.
Yeah, and the teams that do have one, they've got one, and they've got one very specific quality, perhaps, that the team tries to revolve around. This England team can just flick a switch and change the way they approach the game, depending who's up front.
I still think the main decision for Hodgson is whether he plays one or two. And whether he persists with the formation of having Lallana and Sterling, because they are his natural wingers, although Rashford, I thought, came off the bench and he's a very, very bright, intelligent, young, talented footballer. For me, it is still whether they pair two together, because they do have a lot of options. Jamie Vardy, in his pre-match press conference yesterday, he said, I don't think we need to be worried about anybody. We should just go and attack teams. And I would personally like to see England play with two and actually do something. I mean, Poland have two up front because they have Milik and Lewandowski are probably their two best players. And I just wonder whether England, instead of maybe following the formula that so many teams play of that formation, maybe they should be the different ones and say, no, we're gonna do what works in the Premier League with players who are comfortable in those positions and really go for it. I'm intrigued to see who Hodgson does pick against Slovakia.
Yeah, it's a difficult call for him, Tom, now. What do you think he's going to do in that final game against Slovakia? I mean, England are close to qualification anyway, but...
Chris hits the nail on the head when he says perhaps they should go for it. And I think this may represent a bit of a sea change for Hodgson. His hand was forced slightly at half-time. He's received a lot of praise for the substitutions he made, but did he have much choice, really? It's 45 minutes to save, arguably to save the campaign. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Back in England, people are still very sort of cautious about this team, but it looks very likely that the Premier League's top scorer, Harry Kane, 25 goals, is going to be on the bench.
Yes.
You can't have a bad team if that's the situation.
No, absolutely not. Let's focus on Wales next. Let's hear from Gareth Bale, who spoke to our journalist Mark Pittman a couple of days ago.
Obviously, there's a lot of pressure, not just on this last game now, but the other two as well, and I felt like we've dealt with it very well. If anything, I feel like we're probably a bit more relaxed now. We're used to the tensions of the last two games, and we've got used to it, so we all feel very confident. We're looking forward to the game and excited to try and qualify, and come game day we'll be ready and raring to go and trying to qualify for the round of 16.
And frustration for Wales, Tom. I mean, that, you know, Joe Hart probably should have kept out the Gareth Bale free kick in the first half. I think we know that. But you can see a resilience to the way that they play that could see them through to the next stage, because they take on Russia, who are yet to pick up a win.
Absolutely. I think there's two key things for a team at a major tournament who are perhaps... Even Chris Coleman said himself that England, he expected them to have more of the ball. They're a better team on paper. So Wales have their work cut out to advance, but there's two things that are needed for a team like that, and that's strong defence and that five at the back. Even the fullbacks were reticent to push forward against England, and that just makes them so hard to break down. And then you need individual talent, and, well, they've got one player, haven't they, in particular, who he can't win a game on his own, but... We've seen already in the first two games that he gives them a chance. If they're not going to concede many goals, they've always got a chance with Gareth Bale on the pitch.
Something in the final third he can produce.
I also think after the game, there was obvious disappointment. They were gutted. Bale said he was gutted. The fans were. But there was also I don't know if it's a pragmatism of a first-time qualifier, or, you know, certainly in generations of Welsh footballers, that they still have 3 points after two games, and they would have taken that at the start. And there's this very much collective, and I think Bale, in his pre-match press conference ahead of Russia, was quick to say, yeah, it was disappointing, but the game's gone. We're still in a fantastic position to make history.
Yeah, absolutely. Coleman was the same in his post-match press conference in the press room. He came in and he was visibly gutted. He really was. He used words like gut-wrenching.
And he was a lot of gut-based words.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And he was a bit tetchy, to be honest. But as the press conference went on, you could almost see his face. He wasn't going to wallow in it. And he clearly said the same to the players. And I really fancy them against Russia.
That's so interesting you say that, because one of the very things that Gareth Bale said after the game was that the next morning, while it was heartbreaking, in particular because it was England, they had almost pushed the reset button. And it seems maybe the manager was partly down to that. Also, there's something to take away for a lot of English-speaking fans from this tournament as well. This chant that in particular the England fans are singing at the moment. Let's just hear a little bit of this now. Don't Take Me Home, Tom. You recorded that for us at Lens train station. And it's a song that all the England fans are singing, and I actually was struggling to get it out of my head after the game.
I don't think it's ever going to leave my head. Ever. But I mean, I don't want to go home, so it's
perfect. It's absolutely perfect. Chris, so Wales take on Russia next, and England face Slovakia. And Slovakia, after their 2-1 win over Russia, have a certain player in form.
Oh, Marek Hamšík. Possibly the star, along with Lukaku, of match day two. An absolutely outrageous ball to set up Vladimir Weiss for their opening goal against Russia. And then he scored from an almost impossible angle. Yeah, who doesn't like a goal that goes in off the post? It was brilliant. We've seen it all season for Napoli. And he really came alive, because I think Slovakia were very disappointed to have lost to Wales on match day one. But that result put them right in the mix. And I think they can cause England big problems. I think they have pace. I think they have Hamšík will arguably be the most talented player on the pitch, and they'll fancy with 3 points now that they might be able to go to the round of 16.
Okay, let's turn our attention next to Northern Ireland.
For the best coverage and the latest news, follow the @UEFA Euro account on Twitter.
Joining us now, our correspondent with the Northern Ireland team, Graham Little. Graham, thank you very much for coming on the show. What's the mood in the Northern Ireland camp after they beat Ukraine 2-0?
It's completely transformed. It's very upbeat, as you would expect.
a first win in the major championship for 34 years. You know, I think the dominant emotion is probably one of relief, I suspect, as well, because I think they genuinely were crestfallen after the Poland game, not just with losing, but more with the way they played. They felt that they let everybody down, including themselves and including the enormous army of Northern Ireland fans to which they're very attached. Everybody really genuinely sees it as a collective effort between the players and the fans. And I think that given that that was such a limp performance against Poland, they really felt they were under a bit of pressure to improve on that against Ukraine. I think the win is almost a bonus. What they wanted more than anything is just to show that they were better than the Poland game suggested, and that they really did deserve to be here. So the fact that they delivered that performance and also then a win and two goals, it just really was the icing on the cake. So they're hugely upbeat. They're absolutely delighted with how they played, and they honestly are really looking forward to the Germany game. And I didn't get any sense of dread or fear or any idea that they'll be over odds. They genuinely have their tails up, and I think they're going to take the game to them.
Graham, I remember reading something you wrote around the game, saying that Michael O'Neill's team selection for the Ukraine match could be interpreted as bold or balmy. Did he take a massive risk with his team selection for the Ukraine game?
Without a doubt. I put that to him at the end of the match, and he was almost a little taken aback that, I think he was almost surprised that everybody thought it was so bold. But there's absolutely no doubt that it was, five changes and leave it to a man who's become the biggest player we've had for a decade. And Kyle Lafferty, 17 international goals. He's the second highest Northern Ireland goal scorer of all time. He scored 7 in qualifying. He scored again in the friendly against Belarus. And then to sort of something, he's the only person people were asking about in the run-up to this tournament. And then for him to be dropped after one game was a massive decision. Michael is very analytical about everything. He's forensic. He basically said he did the analysis and looked at the analysis. He ran the figures, I suppose, to borrow an accountancy phrase. And he decided the way he wanted to play the game. And that's why he made those 5 selections. And, as everybody said, we shouldn't have questioned him. He got us to the qualifiers, and we certainly can't question him now, because the turnaround and the level of performance and the result, that's the proof that he made the right call. And he was fairly relaxed about it all. He said, I asked him how he slept, once he decided that was going to be the decision, he said he slept fine. And it was just simply the right decision and the right call and the right way to set up.
How special was it for Gareth McCauley to score the first goal in that win?
Massive. Again, I spoke to him after the match, and he almost looked drained. It was as if he hadn't quite come to terms with it. He said that he remembers every millisecond of the goal. He remembers the ball coming in. He said everything after that was a complete blur. He doesn't fully remember the chest slide, but it was on his bucket list, so he was happy to tick that off. He's a guy that encapsulates everything about the Northern Ireland team. He's somebody who was a fan, didn't play professional football until he was in his mid-20s, and has then gone about making up for that in the last 11 years. He's become an absolute fan hero. He scored a good amount of goals in qualifying as well. He's got 8 international goals, and for a Northern Ireland player, that's pretty high. Certainly for a defender, it's massive. Keith Gillespie played 86 caps and only, I think, scored 2. So for a defender to score 8 at this point is huge, and he will not ever... he's 36 now. His career isn't going to go on forever. He has not and will not score a more important goal than that. It was, people joked after him, he's already the new Jerry Armstrong. He can live off that for the next 34 years, just like Jerry has off the Spain 82 goal. So it was huge for him in a whole lot of ways. And first and foremost, it was huge for him because, as I said, he's a hugely committed Northern Ireland player, but also a fan. And I think he got it immediately, how important that was.
And I see as well, Graham, based on your reports on UEFA.com, that there are a few famous faces around as well supporting Northern Ireland.
Yes, there's been loads. It's a kind of a sort of a Northern Ireland tradition now. Where's Charlie Lawson? Oh, there he is. He's posting videos of himself celebrating. Where's Jimmy Nesbitt? There he is. In typical form, having great crack. Carl Frampton's been here, the world champion. Keith Gillespie and Colin Murray crowd surfing around one of the streets of Lyon with all the fans. I'll never forget that. And, again, that's just, it's sort of felt like this huge, big, inclusive party. Nobody's been excluded. Everybody's been a part of it and nobody's been above it. that's been the way that everybody, that's been the general perception, and that, you know, that's the way it panned out. So it was great to see those two, particularly someone like Gillespie, who is an icon for the Northern Ireland fans, and for him to be in the fan zone with them and, you know, been happy to be thrown in the air and, you know, take a million selfies and all that. He was more than happy, and, you know, Keith just likes a party anyway, but they, you know, genuinely, it was just extraordinary in the on after, and you know, no nastiness, just great humour, and it went on, I don't know what time those guys finished up, I wouldn't like to guess.
So how do you see the Germany game going, Graham? 0-0, they drew with Poland in their last match.
It's difficult. I mean, it would be great to dream that what happened against Ukraine can happen again against Germany. To be more realistic about it, it's an enormous challenge for Northern Ireland. It's an enormous challenge for practically any other team in the world to play against Germany. You know, they are the world champions for a reason. That's only a couple of years ago. It's still essentially the same team. In my opinion, they're still as strong. Having said that, I mean, I take everything that the players and the manager in Northern Ireland have said over the last few days. They won't be overawed. You know, I think they've got that out of their system against Poland. I think they'll go and attack. And this is the position that they're familiar with. You know, they're used to being the underdogs. They're used to being written off. And they're used to going out and snapping and biting and playing the way they have done for the last 10 years. So I think we're not going to see free-flowing football from Northern Ireland. I think we're going to see them chasing and harrying and attacking. You know, it'll be counter-attacks if it's anything. I think as well, they really will drill down in the set pieces. It's been an area of expertise for them for the last couple of years. And realistically, it's still probably their best chance of a goal. So I do think they're a decent bet to score. And I think they'll certainly frighten Germany in some respects. I think it's, and more than anything, one thing you can guarantee is it's going to be an extraordinary occasion. The atmosphere in the Parc de France, which is a brilliant old ground, is going to be electric. I'm kind of glad it's not in the Stade de France or somewhere bigger, because the Northern Ireland fans could contribute to that becoming a cauldron. You know, it's nothing that the German players won't have seen before, but I just think it's going to be a brilliant occasion again. And whatever happens. And in some respects, the pressure's off Northern Ireland again. They've come out, you know, the Ukraine, they've shown a really high level of performance. They've got two goals. They've got a win. You know, so they have proved that they did deserve to be here after all. So whatever happens against Germany is almost a bonus. It would be brilliant to see them. If they snatch a draw, they're going through. You know, they'll know that. They could still go through anyway, of course. So all won't be lost if there is defeat. But I just hope they do themselves justice, and I fully expect them to.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see that, you know, the Ukraine players after the game admitted that perhaps they underestimated Northern Ireland. What have I know you've been catching up with some of the squad today, Graham, doing interviews. What have they been saying ahead of the Germany match?
Yes, I spoke to Josh McGuinness and Stuart Dallas today. They were tremendous. They were like a double act in the press conference. Very funny. They were talking us through the goal. Of course, the big thing about Niall McGinn's second goal was Josh McGuinness's part of it. He was sent on after 85 minutes to basically run down the clock, you know, run off, chase every ball, run after the players, and if he got it, just to take it into the corner and waste time. That was the brief, and he didn't really stick to it, because when he got the ball, instead of going to the corner, he said that he heard every single person in the stand, the Northern Ireland person in the stands. He claims he heard Michael O'Neill above everybody else, and he says, but I saw there was an opportunity with, you know, 2-on-2 in the box, and he said, I'll close my eyes and hope for the best. So it worked out, and he said, you know, it was risk over reward, and thankfully the reward is we've two goals, and he made a very good point, actually. You know, the reward is that they've improved their goal difference, which could become crucial if Northern Ireland are to go through as one of the, you know, more realistically, their best chance to go through is as one of the best placed third teams. And, you know, and that is a good point he made, that, you know, their goal difference is now plus one. So I think that's, you know, pretty key. He was very funny. He was talking as well about what it was like in that change room after the match. And he said there was just so much emotion. Johnny Evans in particular, extremely emotional, because he suddenly realised his whole family were in the ground and he was on the pitch with his brother in the biggest moment in Northern Ireland sport, or certainly Northern Ireland football for, you know, for 30 years since Mexico 86. So, you know, he said it was a really special place to be. Stuart Dallas, again, as well, said that he feels that the team spirit within the Northern Ireland squad is the absolutely central component. It's why they're here. He said it's something they've worked hard on, and they all get on so brilliantly. There's no splits within the camp. You know, you've got in Northern Ireland people playing in the Premier League. You've got people playing in League One, in the SPL, in the Championship. And he said it doesn't make a difference. Everybody's in it together, and they're genuinely very close.
Graham, thank you so much for coming on the latest edition of the podcast.
You're welcome, Rob.
For the latest news from inside the team camps, go to Euro2016.com.
Okay, let's finish the show with talking about Group A. Chris and Tom are still with me. Tom, France left it late against Albania. They take on Switzerland next, but they got that 2-0 victory against Albania.
Yeah, the kings of suspense, according to L'Equipe's headline the following day, as has been the case in the tournament as a whole, late goals, and France no more so than anyone else. Payet, again, was one of the scorers, and I mean, he's been ridiculous, hasn't he? And I think they are showing that they've got a squad. It's not just a 4 or 5 brilliant players we know they've got, but they've got options. And Deschamps obviously made some changes. There were some suggestions that it was carrying Knox and, you know, rotation. And I think he kind of felt that he could win that game perhaps with 1 or 2 changes. Maybe wasn't the case in the end, but it was, shows the importance of substitutes again, same as in the England game. And Roy Hodgson actually said after that that how important they'll be in the tournament, and France have shown that as well. Yeah, I mean, I watched that game outside a cafe near where we're staying. It wasn't a raucous atmosphere, but when those goals went in, it was pretty lively. And I think the French fans are starting to think, actually, you know, we've got a chance here. We've not played very well yet, really. And they got 6 points and they're the first team through.
Chris, you're in the fan zone by the Eiffel Tower. You're spending a lot of time there, mate.
Yeah, I thought that was my job.
Fan zone reporter.
Yes, exactly.
But you love it down there.
It's a lovely atmosphere. I'd echo what Tom said. There's a sort of quiet French confidence. It's very, very different to watching it in a British fan zone. They expect their team to go through the group stage, and they have done. It was actually similar. I was in France before the World Cup in 1998, and it felt then slightly similar. And as the tournament built and they got through the quarterfinals, the semifinals, suddenly everything is France, Allez les Bleus. They looked impressive. Dimitri Payet is, for me, the player of the tournament. Very few attacking players have really stood out. He, in both games, has been man of the match.
And to think he might not have even ended up in the France squad at all. Chris, Romania played out a 1-1 draw with Switzerland in their game. Romania weren't too far away from actually winning that one.
No, they weren't. Another penalty from Stancu put them into the lead. Memedy with a really, really good finish, actually, from a corner. Got Switzerland the point. And actually, to come back to the Don't Take Me Home in the fan zone, a Romanian on his own was just singing it in kind of broken English. It was a great scene because I knew exactly what he was singing, but 90,000 French people just looked slightly bemused at him.
So I think in conclusion, no one wants to go home. So Romania take on Albania next. France, Switzerland, all to play for, still in that group as well. Tom, to finish the podcast, I know you don't like this bit because you don't like the predictions, but we need a surprise result for the third round of group games.
There's a reason I don't like the predictions, Rob. Last time I deliberately stayed away from Northern Ireland.
Well, you wanted to go for it and you said you changed your mind and they did win.
They did. Well, yeah, they did win 2-0. Thanks for reminding me. I am going to go for this time. I fancy Croatia to get a point against Spain. Yeah,
nice.
I think they've looked excellent. Midfielders are superb, aren't they? As good as, I think we may have even mentioned this previously in a podcast, may have a, you know, as good a midfielders as anyone else in the tournament, really. I've got the whole package, and I think Spain maybe, you know, will they make a change or two perhaps? And I think
you'd have thought, yeah. Interesting to see how they do. And it's whether Croatia regroup after the 2-2 draw against the Czechs. Chris, any surprise result?
I think it's even harder to predict because you mentioned Spain, Tom. Antonio Conte has inferred that he's going to make changes now Italy are through and as group winners. I sort of spoke about it. I think Slovakia will get something against England.
I would tell you what that means for the group, but the presentation's computer's about to blow up. Chris and Tom, thank you very much for coming on the show. We'll be back ahead of the round of 16 when we'll know who is into the knockout stage of UEFA Euro 2016.
Thanks for listening to the official UEFA Euro 2016 podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes or follow us on SoundCloud.